Covered in Glory is presented for the people by Caesars Sportsbook, the greatest sports betting app of all time. Download it, must be 21 years or older. Welcome back to another edition of Covered in Glory, where I yelled so loud last week, it completely broke the mic. But what is not broken, my friend Brett, is my spirit, because the Premier League is back. I got to watch footy all weekend, and the news is flying fast and furious. There's never a dull moment. How did you enjoy the opening weekend of the Premier League season?
Well, I watched Wolves United to end it. So it's like one of those things where you have a great meal and then your dessert sucks and all you can remember is how bad the dessert was. but no, I mean, it was great. There was a lot of interesting stuff that happened. Some pretty decent games. And I mean, it's back. Like, that's all you got to say, man. It's just back. And I can't wait to see how things unfold.
Yeah, it felt warm. It felt comfortable. Felt like that nice bath that you've been waiting for all day. You slip into it, and it's just the same as it always is. City is dominant. Other teams are terrible, and the games are on in the morning, which is glorious. And so I don't know. I didn't realize how much I missed the Premier League. I thought in watching the Women's World Cup and watching Messi in the MLS and getting to go to some of the preseason action, things like that, that would be an adequate replacement. But there's just nothing like it. There's just nothing like, you know, settling into the couch at 7:30 a.m. or 10 a.m. or whatever on a Saturday morning and getting to watch the actual best players in the world really ply their trade and entertain you for the next couple hours.
Yeah, I mean, and there's just going to be so many fascinating storylines. I mean, we are going to hear all about it from you on one of them, which is all the defensive midfielders are now on Chelsea. And so I think the fun part is, too, is like we got a glimpse of some of these teams. We're not going to see the finished product. And, you know, you had kind of mentioned that last week. And so I think this year is just going to be, it's going to kind of make up for last year being mostly pretty dull. Obviously, we had the title run extend further than we thought it did, but kind of everything else in the middle wasn't too great. I know you would like to forget last year, and this year offers a bunch of promise. So I think it's gonna be fun to follow.
Well, there you go. You know what's not dull, though, Brett? You know what's not dull is overreacting big time to just 1 week of action. So I sent you the question beforehand. Let's tackle it now. What is your biggest overreaction in the world of soccer since last week's show?
I think your second favorite club, Manchester United, might be terrible. I watched in its entirety because there was money involved, the entirety of their match against Wolves. And if you remember, we shouted out Lopetegui, who left Wolves before they brought in Gary O'Neill, who was Bournemouth's caretaker manager, who kept them up 4 days, I think, before the match. And Wolves bossed the pitch. And there's some clear warning signs with United that I think, you know, they overperformed last year. They're great in one goal matches. That's usually not a sustainable way to continue to win soccer matches. Obviously, I'm kidding in terms of they're terrible, but they definitely are not looking like a Champions League caliber club in the slightest. They started Garnacho and Anthony on the wings. I've never been a huge Anthony guy. His price tag suggested that when he came over from Ajax, that United was kind of getting this finished product in the mold of, you know, an established young superstar on the level of maybe Jadon Sancho. But the truth is Anthony was young, but like his numbers were okay. Like he was like a pretty good prospect that played for the most dominant team in a league that's known for goal scoring being a lot easier. And then Garnacho just looked completely lost. Like every decision he made with the ball against Wolves was terrible. Rashford is, you know, he's a good player, but in the striker role, I don't think that's where he wants to be. Your boy Mason Mount, I couldn't even know if he did anything remotely impactful because I barely saw him in open play touch the ball. And I mean, again, their system kind of relies on like Aaron Wan-Bissaka getting forward and making plays in the box. The goal by Varane was actually set up by Wan-Bissaka. And for those of you who aren't total soccer nerds, Aaron Wan-Bissaka is definitely not known for his final third prowess, and was actually rumored to be shipped off when Ten Hag took over the job. it was just really bad. I mean, they got beat by a very mediocre Wolves team with a caretaker manager who came in 4 days prior. And I mean, they were outplayed. And if there wasn't a weird VAR incident where Onana basically like decapitated one of their backup strikers, that match is a tie. And it probably should have went Wolves' way anyways. It should have been a Wolves win.
Yeah, so I wasn't expecting you to say that. So I was just scrambling while you were talking and looking up some odds. Let's define terrible. Let's define terrible in a gambling sense. Where do you think that, based on one game and one hot take that you want to throw out here, where are they going to finish on the table? And let's put some money on it.
Their floor has dropped all the way to probably seventh or eighth to me. And I didn't think that was the case before that. Beforehand.
Plus 100 to not finish top four on Caesars right now. Plus 100. You're taking it after one game. Would you have taken it before that game?
No, I actually kind of thought they were the favorite for the fourth spot. So, it was a big change. I mean, it just, the circumstances involved, they had a bunch of their new pieces in, and Wolves were a mess, and their Wolves are not very good to begin with. And at Old Trafford, like, it completely pushed my opinion to be like, their floor is way lower than I thought it was.
Okay. All right. Plus 100 and not finish top four. Brett is locking that into his year after just seeing them play Wolves. I mean, I saw a lot of what you saw in that matchup, and I'll talk about it a little bit more when we get into the individual games this week. The Onana thing was crazy. I mean, he's a madman. He's a liability. So yeah, I guess that's just part of the package when he comes in. And it was shocking. It was just shocking how much space that Wolves had throughout the entire match. I mean, particularly Neto, like it was like visually confusing. Like, it's like when you see Usain Bolt sprinting and you realize there's supposed to be other humans around him, but there's nobody in the same plane. Like, I have no idea why nobody was getting close to him and closing him out. And so I guess I could see how you could react that way, particularly against a team that I gave out last week as a relegation contender. But that seems like a quick fall from grace from, I think they are top four, to give me the plus 100, no chance they're going to fall down to eighth.
Yeah, I mean, look, a lot would have to probably go wrong for them, but we did talk in week one, or I at least said in week one, I won't attach you to my anchor that's going to the bottom of the ocean. United was hugely reliant on outstanding performances from Casemiro and Rashford. And I think that really showed again. I mean, Rashford wasn't world superstar last week, and they had a bunch of trouble scoring. And that was kind of the case when you were portfolio betting him for about 15 matches straight. Rashford was operating like a top five player in the world, right? You know?
Yeah.
And if he's not that player, which I'm not sure that's his sustainable peak, that's a problem for them because there's not very much good around him.
Yeah. He was frustratingly anonymous in that matchup for a guy that I've been touting, you know, since last year. And that's been extraordinarily profitable for me in the gambling sense. And so, okay. All right. Well, it's down on wax now. You can't take it back. We're going to play this back in May and see where we're at. My biggest overreaction should not be a surprise. As a Chelsea fan, I feel like I just had my first breath of fresh air since like we went out on our shield against Madrid defending the World Cup. The week we had both on and off the pitch, even if it was a 1-1 draw, was just so incredible. So my overreaction of the week is the Blue Dynasty is simply moving south, and London is the home of the next city. Chelsea is going to win multiple Premier League titles in the next 6 years. We have now stacked the deck to run from current. I'm not saying we'll win this year, but Pep's going to retire, or Pep's going to move on to his next challenge. He'll take a year off. City will not be the same without him. And based on our off the pitch activity this week, there is nobody better set up in the world to fill City space after Haaland goes to Madrid and Pep goes down to, I don't know, some beach in Portugal to reset. The youth revolution that they have set up is absolutely incredible. The midfield that they're about to start rolling out is like a soccer nerd's wet dream. I cannot believe actually that you didn't call me just begging to get Chelsea gear shipped to you immediately. Like, I think that you are going to never love this team, and they are going to replace Everton for you before you know it. Because when you have Lavia,
Brighton's already done that, Toby.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, we have Lavia, Casado, and Enzo, and that's going to be your midfield. Like, it's just going to be absolutely incredible. And if Jackson actually pops the way it looks like he's capable of, like, I don't see what the limit is for them. And not saying they're going to win it this year, but they are showing such positive intent. Their age profile is absolutely perfect for when City declines, when Pep leaves. And I think they are fully capable of ripping off three titles before 2030.
Yeah, that is, that's definitely, that's going to top my overreaction. It's interesting. They were the most interesting team of the weekend to me, like, by far. You mentioned Nicholas Jackson. He was really good in that match against Liverpool. I mean, really good. He played about 1600 minutes with Villarreal last year. I mean, that's like no joke when you're 21 year olds playing in the second best league in the world. You know, he had 12 goals and he had like three or four assists. I mean, a bunch of goal involvement, matches underlying numbers. Like, he could be legit. And that's what Chelsea need, right? I mean, after you suffered through your goal drought last year, they need one of their young attackers to pop and be a threat to score 20 goals in a season. Is Jackson that guy? I don't know. If he is, it's definitely going to change their trajectory for sure.
I mean, I just think the timeline's critical here, right? Like, Arsenal's playing somewhat of the same game. City is City, and I think they're just going to dominate as long as that current structure is in place. Maybe we'll be lucky enough to continue to see a horse race like we did last year, and Liverpool pushed them the year before. Maybe somebody will step up to that challenge, but it always ends the same way. But eventually it will not end that way, and who's going to be well placed to fill their mantle? And it's Chelsea and Arsenal. And based on our signings this week and the activity that we did in the offseason and what I saw from Poch and what I saw from the system and things like that against a good Liverpool team. I mean, they were the team that actually played somebody up to their level of everybody else in the top six in the opening weekend. And I thought they were clearly the better side. I know I have blue colored glasses, but I think the underlying stats would bear that out. And I think if you talk to Liverpool fans, they walked away frustrated while Chelsea fans walked away elated. And maybe that's more about the expectations entering the match, but just, it was incredible. And then, like, to have us beat Liverpool twice in the boardroom in the next couple of days, in the signings that came over, and then you just look at the embarrassment of riches. I mean, what's nuts about it, Brett, is Reece James is now the most senior player at Chelsea. Reece James is 23 years old. It is the only player on the entire roster to make an appearance wearing the royal blue before 2020. That's it. They have turned over the entire roster. And once Ziyech leaves and Lukaku leaves and Silva finally retires, I don't know, 12 or 13 years from now, every single player they have that is important to them is 26 or under. And most of them are 22 and under. So they are just set up perfectly to peak right when Pep rides off in the sunset, right when Haaland takes his $100 billion to go to Real to either play with Mbappe or be the Mbappe replacement. And I couldn't be more giddy. And so I won't do this every single week, but I did suffer a lot last year, as you already pointed out. And this week felt like the reward.
Yeah. I mean, listen, there is no question. There's a ton of optimism with the way that they're building this, especially because for a team to kind of rise from the ashes, what you really need for the most part, if you can't get the star players, especially because, you know, they're not in the Champions League, so that attraction isn't there for them this year, you have to hope that you sign a bunch of 22, 23-year-olds and three or four of them turn into elite players about the same time. And that's how you end up peaking and stealing some titles. So they definitely have that blueprint in place. You know, well, I mean, soccer is crazy and random and weird, so who knows what will happen in 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, but they're certainly set up for a really promising future.
Yeah, not having Champions League really killed our ability to sign players this year. Everybody was totally right about that. All right. So now we got those overreactions out of the way. Let's go ahead and take a quick break, reset, and get into this week's action.
Why should you bet with Caesars Sportsbook? Two words, Caesars Rewards. Every bet brings you closer to the types of benefits only Caesars can offer. Hotel stays, VIP experiences, sports and concert tickets, and more. It's not just an app, it's an empire.
You must be 21 and older and physically present in Arizona, Colorado, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Louisiana, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Nevada, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, Wyoming, or Washington, D.C. Sports betting is void in Georgia, Hawaii, Utah, and other states where prohibited. No one stop before you start. If you have a gambling problem, Illinois, Maryland, New Jersey, Ohio, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, Pennsylvania. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem, crisis counseling and referral services can be accessed by calling 1-800-GAMBLER or Maryland, visit mdgamblinghelp.org or West Virginia, visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net. Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. Colorado, DC, Nevada, Wyoming, Kansas, call 1-800-522-4700. Indiana, call 1-800-9-WITH-IT. Iowa, call 1-800-BETS-OFF. Louisiana, call 1-877-770-STOP. Massachusetts, if you or a loved one is experiencing problems with gambling, please call 1-800-327-5050 or visit gamblinghelplinema.org for 24/7 support. Michigan, call 1-800-270-7117. New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NEW YORK or text HOPENY.
Okay, our first game this week involves Big Six clubs, although we are about to talk about that. The first one is Spurs, currently ninth with 1 point versus United, seventh at 3 points and still standing despite the drive-by that Brett just put on them. This game is Saturday at 12:30 p.m. United is plus 130, Spurs are plus 180, the draw is plus 270. Caesars has United at minus half a goal at plus 125 and Spurs on the double chance at minus 160. All right, Brett, we talked about this a little bit last week, but I wanted specifically to take that break, very specifically to take that break, so everybody understands that what I'm about to say is absolutely not an overreaction. It has been a long time coming. I want to have a real conversation right now about whether we should still consider the Spurs a top six team and whether they should continue to take that mantle and enjoy that title and that place and prestige in the conversations in the soccer world. Because for me, Brett, the Big Six is not where they should finish on the table year every year. It's not like every single year there'll be no variation, and this should be the six clubs that run from one through six at the top. It is more about economic power and ambition and a mix of results beyond those. And I absolutely cannot see it with Spurs. And after the Harry Kane news, after he formally moved to Bayern, which was right in the middle of our show last week, it looked like it was going to happen. And now that it did, I don't see how this team belongs with the other five teams that we talk about week in, week out. Where is the evidence? Where is the evidence that they have the ambition, that they have the drawing power, that they have the economics? What are they going to do with this Kane money? What are they going to do to reinvest? Because I watched that team that rolled out there in the first week, and I saw Richarlison up top. I saw a washed winger. I saw Madison, and I saw some other guys who just never lived up to their promise. And tell me how this is different than Everton. Tell me how this is different than other mid-table teams that we don't talk about in the same breath as City, at the same breath as United, at the same breath as Chelsea. It does not look like they belong in that class. And as long as they're going to behave this way, and as long as they're not going to win trophies, as long as they're really not going to go after it, why should they continue to enjoy this vaunted status where they get talked about in the same breath as those other teams?
I mean, I think you're right. I don't think that they're there. I mean, the trophy closet would be a pretty good argument for them. You know, the pretty much the Champions League final was where they peaked. And even that run in the kind of the dying embers of the Pochettino era was a little bit lucky to even get to that point in general. And that was kind of the peak of their last, I don't know, 5-6 years where they've kind of been considered firmly back into this top six group. But I mean, look, this is a huge thing. It is really hard, even if you're a club owned by a petrol state or a forward-thinking club like Brighton, to replace somebody of Harry Kane's caliber. And we saw with what happened with Gareth Bale. They took a bunch of money for Gareth Bale, and it never really turned into this like-for-like replacement. And if it wasn't for Kane and Son and those guys kind of hitting their peaks at the same time with a manager who came in with this like more aggressive system when teams were still playing more passive, there was no way that they were going to come out of the Gareth Bale hole. So this one seems more dire. It seems more serious. Brighton is pretty much clearly showing that they're just doing things smarter than everybody else. And Newcastle is backed by oil money. And I think those teams from this point forward should probably be considered locks to be finish ahead of them in the table.
Brighton doesn't fit the profile, right? Like, you're right. You're talking about results, but again, we're back to like attitude and perspective and the way they kind of attack things. And I understand I'm a Chelsea fan. If you listen to the top of the show, it's very clear what team I support. And it's kind of like me sitting on Logan Roy's yacht and talking about all the other boats in the harbor. But at the same time, like, we make fun of United all the time. The Paul Pogba signing was a statement. Bringing Ronaldo back was a statement. Spending $70 million on Casemiro was a statement of intent. Even when moves don't work out, at least they're going for it. At least City goes for it. At least Poole goes for it. At least Arsenal goes for it. They just spent over $100 million on Rice and a lot of money on Havertz, et cetera, and so forth. And so this is more an idea of clustering. Like, you just want to correctly cluster the teams. I mean, Spurs still, you know, they play in the Premier League. They play in the modern day Super League. And I'm not saying they don't belong there, but if we're going to tier them based on ambition and based on power and based on how massive the club is, they simply do not belong until proven otherwise.
Yeah. I mean, they don't have the stature. Teams like Chelsea, teams like United, Real Madrid, Barcelona, they will always attract players because of their history, because of their tradition, because young soccer players have grown up watching the great Chelsea teams, watching the great United teams, watching the great Madrid teams, etc. Spurs don't even really have that like ability to do that in their recruitment. And so what they really needed to be in order to weather these kind of storms is a process-driven team, because they weren't ever. Daniel Levy's one thing that, if I mean, Spurs fans are going to have their critiques of him, obviously, but his one thing was he was never going to put the club in a financially compromising situation, which means spending more than you're bringing in revenue-wise just to try to land big-name players. He was never going to do that. And I think like that's going to be something that you could say, well, it's made them sustainable. It's made sure that they stay solvent, that, you know, that they didn't fall down the table and go the route of Portsmouth. But it obviously clearly limited their ceiling, especially in their years where they were making the Champions League. They had opportunities to maybe just push the limit, try to spend that money, increase their wage structure, all those kinds of things. And they never really took that opportunity to do it. And so now they're in the midst of this mass rebuild with no system in place. Clearly no appeal for any players to come play for them that are established stars. It's just looking increasingly ugly for them.
Yeah. I mean, look, they have some advantages. They have some name brand recognition. They have a beautiful stadium and new stadium, and they're in London. But hey, I just described West Ham with a better publicist, except for one thing. West Ham won a trophy last year. West Ham won a trophy. So give me West Ham over Spurs in terms of who should actually belong in this conversation. And otherwise, I don't see how you separate the two. And I see very clearly how you separate the Spurs from the other five. So I'm officially announcing it, as far as I'm concerned, they are suspended from the big six. They are suspended pending to see how they spend this Harry Kane money and the rest of this window, maybe in January, but they just don't belong. And they can be entertaining. I mean, you called it out. Postecoglou's style was like wide open, and that was a very entertaining match that they played, but it is embarrassing to compare them off the pitch to those other five clubs. And by the way, Emerson Royale, who I think might have been one of their 10 biggest signings ever, he's at least very close in terms of value, was flat out horrible in that game. And if he didn't score that goal, we'd have just been talking about him this entire time of how much he kept getting burnt down the side. It really, like, I don't know, man. I don't know if I'm having too big a reaction in that game, but Brentford, they won on XG. I know a lot of that was lifted by the penalty. And Tottenham spent the whole game marking. Like, the difficulty level was turned down in FIFA. That second goal in Brentford was just a simple pullback into an acre of space, like 12 yards out from the box, and nobody closed out and the guy just finished. So while it's going to be entertaining, it's embarrassing. And I know United didn't look good. If you had told me United had had two guys red carded in the first minute and that's why the Wolves were able to boss them so much, I'd have believed it. I absolutely would have believed they had two guys sent off for the very first whistle. But at the same time, like, come on, in this individual matchup, no matter how much you hate United, I can't say all that and go any other way. Fade Spurs, United plus 130 is my pick.
Yeah, no, I think that's that's a good way to look at it. You know, we talked about this last week too. One of the things with this system is you go from Conte, who played this conservative back three, and then you're going to this up-tempo pressing system. And as we saw with Celtic last year, Postecoglou is not going to take his foot off the brake. Like, they are going to play this way, good, bad, or the otherwise. And there's going to be a pretty rough adjustment period, I think, because I don't think a lot of their players are suited for this system. It's going to just be such a departure from how they played last year in general, that we may not even see the best version of this collection of Spurs talent for 3-4 months. And if it wasn't for the fact that I watched United just completely crumble against Wolves, I would be all there, because the only way to fade both teams, Toby, is to do what I always do and take the coward's way out.
Yeah.
And take the draw at plus 265. Because
I absolutely hate that pick, Brett. I'm sorry to cut you off. I absolutely hate that pick for one simple reason. In a game that's projected to be this open, the chance that it lands, you know, the quarter that you're flipping lands on its end is just, it just seems so low to me. And when you have an over number, I don't know. Did you see the juice on the over number? To take over 2.5 is minus 175. So you're talking about any game that's expected to have 3, 4, or 5 goals ending in a draw. I just don't see the value.
Yeah, I mean, look, listen, it's obviously very tricky to dance the fault line of taking a draw, as we've argued about week after week. But the reason I always fall to it is that more games than you think end up being in that, whether the style of play is what it is. It's going to be a low-scoring game or high-scoring match. And I mean, there's no evidence to me that says there's value on either side of that line. Yeah. Neither of these teams show me value. And so if I think these teams are fairly evenly matched, and I think they're both clearly struggling to find something together, I just don't know where else to turn. You know what I mean?
Well, break out all your spreadsheets, do your nerd stuff, and tell me how many draws, what percentage of draws are 2-2 versus 0-0 and 1-1. Because it's got to be like, I think it's going to be shockingly low. But if it's higher than I think and more games actually do end in that 2-2 range, then I'll be shut up and you'll be justified. And I won't make fun of you for picking a defender to score for at least a week.
at least 1 week.
I'm doing what I do because, again, I got to stick true to myself. In a game where both defenses are so horrible, in a game where it's going to be this open and it just looks like it's going to be a track meet back and forth, give me the over on the corners, man. I know it's cliche. I know I like to scream about it and things like that. But the over 9.5 is minus 150, and I'm going to go ahead and take it up to over 10.5 at plus 105. There were 15 in that Wolves United game last week, and Spurs had 6 of their own. And so I just think there's an excellent chance when neither side seems interested whatsoever in marking and controlling that there's going to be a lot of action and a lot of scrambling with the ball going over the touchline because there's just desperation defending as people run up and down the pitch.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about desperation depending. This is the type of match that your boy, Marcus Rashford, thrives on, right? I mean, pretty much every time that United gets in a situation where they have to counterattack and Rashford has a bunch of open space, he typically produces pretty good performance. He's plus 150 as an anytime goal scorer. This seems perfectly set up for him. I'm stealing a Toby bet here, which I don't mind because Toby made a lot of money on this bet last year. I may be getting in a little bit late. I don't think the pricing at plus 150 is that great, but this is the exact type of match that a Rashford goal would pop up in, and he is by far the most likely United front three player to score.
Couldn't agree with you more, particularly because he's going to be attacking spaces that Royale allegedly occupies. I don't know what he's actually doing, but that's where he's supposed to be. And I think he's going to pop in there and he's going to get a goal. I did write that one down. I'm just picking a couple of other anytime goal scorers later, and I didn't want to be repetitive. So I 100% back Brett's bet here. Let's move to the next match and a discussion about the Big Six again. I know we haven't talked about the Big Six for a while. Manchester City third at 3 points versus Newcastle first at 3 points, Saturday at 3 p.m. City is minus 155. Newcastle's plus 400. The draw is plus 290. City minus half a goal is minus 165. And Caesars has Newcastle's double chance at plus 127. So, Brett, we did not get a chance to talk much about Newcastle last week. And then they went out and put up a five spot on a really overhyped Aston Villa side. They are in the Champions League this year. They went and bought Tonali, and they are on a clear upward trajectory ever since our show has started. So after I suspended Tottenham, should we just have a big five, or should Newcastle officially be welcome to the big six?
Brighton. Oh, sorry.
They don't have the ambition. Really, they do not
really
have the
ambition. Really dry.
When you sell Casado for $110 and you still shop in the, or $110 million, and you still shop in the bargain bin, you're not a massive club. They can finish top four. Leicester won the whole damn league. Like, people can slide into the top four in results. But when we talk about the big six, it is not just results. It is also ambition and purchasing power and all the other things. So Brighton does not belong in that weight class, even when they punch above it. Even if they're the best pound for pound fighter in the Premier League, they don't belong. Newcastle? I think Newcastle might.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's always going to come down. I mean, this is going to be a litmus test for Brighton in a lot of ways. They do a bunch of really interesting stuff. You talk about them shopping in the bargain bin. I mean, their strategy of essentially selling all these midfielders for huge fees and then reinvesting those fees into a bunch of young players at premium positions, and then using like free transfers to bring guys like James Milner or Mohamed Dahoud, who came over from Dortmund. Like, that's an interesting strategy, but it always comes down to the check. Maybe Brighton is the one team that's going to be so far ahead of everybody else that they're going to be able to beat the checkbook. But I do think because of Newcastle's new spending power, they need to be included in the big six. They just have too much money behind them now for their floor to be that low. It's depressing. I hate saying that, but it's the truth. And I mean, listen, you and I talked about this. I think when the deal broke and we knew the Saudis were going to take over the team, the inevitability is that it's going to be a lot of battles probably in the next 5-10 years with teams like Newcastle and City at the top, just because they have the most money behind them. And I think it's a big six now, and they're the sixth team.
Yeah, so I will say that it's not just the checkbook, because I understand that argument. I've made that argument. I think that argument does have power by itself, but I don't think it is the only thing that we should consider, because the purchases that they're making as they get out of the bargain bin and they're buying are so much better than Tottenham's. Do you know, it's okay, I had the list up. Do you know Tottenham's top three signings in club history by transfer value?
No.
Okay, that's perfectly fine. I didn't either until I looked it up. It's Ndombele, Richarlison, and Christian Romero. So their all-time record spender was Ndombele for $62 million post Gareth Bale. They ended up loaning him back to the same club, and he's like a Napoli bench warmer now. And that's who they spent their money on. Then Richarlison, unless he suddenly becomes a 25 goal guy this year, that's just not money well spent. Romero's better than the first two, but was he worth 50 million? I mean, we'll find out. Newcastle, their top two are Isak and Tonali. Their third is Gordon, and Gordon was only 40 versus Romero at 50. So at least they're getting value when they're starting to grow their purchasing power. So yes, eventually they will be making $100 million purchases. Eventually they will, have a star-studded lineup like the rest of the big six, which is why they belong. But I think it's also fair to point out that the team they're replacing has pissed away their money, and that Newcastle looks like they've done really well with Isak and Tonali.
Yeah, I mean, Tonali will agree to disagree there. He scored. It was a beautiful goal. Don't get me wrong. He played for a Champions League team that was in the semifinals. He's young. I just don't think it was there. I mean, Milan is run by a pretty sharp group that has people like Luke Bourne behind it. And my feeling is when they saw the transfer fee that they were about to get for Tonali, they probably had Milan staffers in his apartment packing his bags for him before they even let him know what was going on. But the bottom line is they've hit on Bruno. I mean, that's a massive signing to get a midfield engine for the price that they did. Isak could be a winger or a forward. He can play alongside Colin Wilson. He can be the sole striker. He's a young player. He had an established track record. I didn't think the Harvey Barnes signing was that great of value, but they played for, they paid for a proven Premier League product at an okay price, I guess. And now they have some depth with guys that they can eat up minutes at that level and produce. Like, they just are going to continue to do things like this. And they don't have to make big, splashy signings. They don't have to beat Richarlison signings or Tanguy Ndombele signings all the time. They just have to get guys that don't fail. And they'll by the amount of spending power that they have, they'll still have a super high floor, which is why...
You already threw his name out. Like, Guy Maurice was their fifth largest signing ever. The fifth largest Spurs signing ever was Pedro Porro. And so, like, it just continues to show the gap in purchasing that they're doing. So
yeah, and there's a clear structure. I mean, whether or not you want to talk about, like, Eddie Howe leading your transfers, that's a whole different conversation. But with Spurs, it's Daniel Levy's kind of been in charge, but he's also moved to the whim of all these different managers, right? Like, he's just there's no stylistic similarities that comes in. He's buying players to fit certain systems, and those managers go. It's like the exact opposite way to run a club. If Eddie Howe is going to be your guy, if he's going to be your Pep, at least, even though he may not be the greatest transfer market guy in the world, you know, it's kind of a little bit of the David Moyes thing where you give him too much power. If you go full Howe, it's too much Howe. But at least there's a common coherent structure, right? At least there's something. Eddie knows some guys that can play in a system. There's a clear chain. Spurs are all over the place. That's another huge difference between these two clubs and how they utilize their money.
Yeah. Well, I thought that Newcastle, when they go out and run Villa through the ringer at 5-1, I thought that was a statement win. I think the statement was probably more about Aston Villa than Newcastle, though. Aston Villa just looked absolutely horrible, and I think they're on our slate next week so we can dig into them more. But Newcastle could have scored 10 goals in that game. It wasn't that they were so amazing. Villa was the worst team of the weekend for me. And then on the other side, like, Newcastle kept letting Diaby into dangerous spaces. So it's not like it was like a lockdown one goal win. Like, you know, Villa still challenged them quite a bit. And Newcastle's not playing Villa this week. They are playing Manchester City, the greatest team in the world. City conceded only 0.33 XG last week against Burnley. I can't even remember what it came from. They had a slightly shaky, like, 4-minute stretch that the only reason I remember it in the middle of the first half was just because how dominant they were the rest of the time, that one or two chances suddenly stands out, even though they weren't good chances. I think that there's absolutely no way that I'm not taking them in this match. And in fact, I'm just introducing a new portfolio bet until it actually fails me, which is Haaland to score, Manchester City to win. Haaland to score, Manchester City to win. I had a bad week at a 5-pint last week, but this was my one win, and I'm just going to keep riding it. You put those two together, it's plus 135. So that's going to have to turn into a negative number before they don't get my money at the window.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great bet. I didn't go there. I just took the City on the money line. And then the other bet that was enticing to me was the under 2.5 goals at plus 105. Last year, when these two teams played each other, obviously there's going to be some differences and changes. There was less than 2 goals worth of chances in that match. I think it's going to be another pretty cagey match between these two clubs. The reinforcements of Tonali in the midfield and just the way that Pep is playing now. This is something that we'll talk about more. I don't want to get on it because we've talked about a million things. We can save this for another pod, but he switched the formation again. Kyle Walker's in there and a straight back 4. It's a little more conservative. Kovacic is going to help more with the possession stuff and circulating the ball. I don't think that they're going to have that De Bruyne. I mean, we were texting about this off air when we were talking about this. Like, Kova isn't De Bruyne in the sense that he can break games open with one pass and create huge chances for Haaland. City aren't going to have that anymore. And so I think that's going to limit. I mean, I think they're going to kind of get their chances through attrition instead of through these inspirational passes by De Bruyne. So I think this is going to be a low scoring match. I think it's going to be relatively ugly. I could see 0-0. I could see 1-1, 2-0 City, things like that. So I like that under getting plus money.
Yeah, I mean, if you really are just like, City's a juggernaut and you want to just keep it rolling, I kind of like, you know, playing a little bit of a wheel here, because two other lines, Manchester City over 1.5 and just the straight up money line, You can take what I did, City to win and Haaland to score +135. You can take City over 1.5 and to win at -110. And you can take City over 1.5 and Haaland scores at +120. And so those three things are I just like betting because history backs me up on it. And you can combine them in any way you want and get a really decent number. So let's go ahead and take our last break. Now that we have the big six sorted forever and nobody else ever has to discuss it again, we've closed the topic for the entire world. We will rip through our last three matches. Okay, we are back and we are heading over to Liverpool, 12th at 1 point versus Bournemouth, 10th at 1 point, Saturday at 10 a.m. Poole is -460. Bournemouth is +1100. The draw is +525. Caesars has Poole -1.5 at -160 and Bournemouth at +125. So last week, Bournemouth drew with West Ham 1-1, and I actually thought they looked like the better side, Brett. Meanwhile, Liverpool simply could not win the ball back from Chelsea. And I think that Liverpool have some bad vibes floating around them right now with Klopp unable to stop talking about the transfer market, the board unable to deliver him targets that he's satisfied with, and Salah having that really weird, like bizarre storming off the field, tearing the tape off his fingers one by one by one with anger and throwing them down to the ground. It actually looked like something that belonged on I Think You Should Leave sketch. I think Dan Flashes should actually start to design their kits. I think that would be amazing and would fit right onto Salah based on his behavior. And so if I'm picking out those vibes and I'm seeing that, it's not like I'm going to do anything crazy like taking Bournemouth outright here. I'm not you. But there's no way I'm going to lay a fat -160 for Poole to win by multiple goals until I actually see them pull it together.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. The Michael Edwards era is clearly officially over in Liverpool, and we're seeing it right now. We have pretty much never seen Liverpool panic buy during the Edwards era. And just this morning, or maybe it was late last night, they went and nabbed a 30-year-old defensive midfielder from 16th place Stuttgart, Waturo Endo. And he not only doesn't exactly fit what they need, but it's clearly a purchase that is motivated in the we just need to do something vein. And that is
signaling... Is that official? Because could Chelsea still come in and hijack it? Could Chelsea turn his head?
I mean, we don't know at this point. Chelsea could hijack me being on the show. Like Enzo Fernandez. Yeah, Enzo Fernandez could be finishing this podcast with you at some point. I'm not sure.
If you think for one hot second that if Enzo popped up on the Zoom right now, I wouldn't kick you off. You are wildly mistaken.
I wouldn't even be mad about that. I would sign off. I'd be like, hey, Eddie, I'm out. I got to go. but no, I think this is kind of an interesting, it's the end of the Liverpool Moneyball era, essentially, is what I'm getting at. And they have a huge flaw in their system. Klopp is an ideologue. He is going to play his heavy metal 4-3-3. He is going to press. He sort of tweaked it a little bit with the Trent Alexander-Arnold move where he kind of drifts inside during the match. But then we opened up this first week with Alexis McAllister, who was playing near the goal as like an eight for Brighton as their six.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. And so the Bournemouth at +1.5 at +130. I'm really interested in Bournemouth this year. I know it's crazy. Those are weird words to say. I would say, and you can back me up on this, but 100% of the time that an English caretaker manager has a nice stretch that keeps a team up, he keeps his job. And Bournemouth let go of Gary O'Neill, and they hired Antoni Iriola, who basically comes from Rayo Vallecano. And Rayo is an interesting club. They're kind of like the ugly stepsister, I guess, of Madrid. They're an interesting club. If you ever have a chance, you definitely read the history of Rayo. But they have like no budget, and they finished 11th last year in La Liga. That was all Iriola. He's got some very interesting ideas with his pressing, and it's just an interesting move by Bournemouth. Like, they clearly saw a manager outperforming his resources. They could have very, very easily been justified sticking with the status quo, keeping Gary O'Neill around. But they saw an opportunity for change and something better. I think this guy has a chance to be a pretty good manager. We don't know. It's the Premier League. It's the Super League. It's a big step up from La Liga and Rayo. But they're interesting to me this year. And David Brooks is back, which is a really cool story. I mean, the guy had leukemia. He was a really promising prospect. I think even like 2 or 3 years ago, he was ironically on Liverpool's radar. And then he obviously had the illness. He's come back. He was really lively in the first match. To kind of get like a really promising young attacker back in your setup without spending money for a team like Bournemouth is a massive boost. So I think they're more competent than we might have seen last year. And again, a lot of it is just Liverpool didn't look good. Chelsea was the better team for the last 60 minutes of that match. And Liverpool has a gaping flaw in their setup. So no way, shape or form am I taking them to cover over 2 goals.
Cool. The one guy I did like, well, actually, Szoboszlai was good. McAllister, I mean, despite being widely outcast, did play a super ball up to Salah for their one goal. He put in a workman shift in a job he absolutely shouldn't be doing. I can't believe that they paid that money and then put him in that role. So I think the signings they made, you know, showed promise and didn't show like Szoboszlai is going to need a ton of time to embed, but they need 3 or 4 more signings and their board just doesn't seem capable of getting it done. But they did get a boost from not a new signing, but a face that's so welcome to see again, which is Luis Diaz. He scored in the opening match. He is an absolute dog. Despite playing for, you know, Liverpool, he's just one of those guys like Kevin De Bruyne and a bunch of others that I just love watching week in, week out. And Caesars is boosting him this week. So if you go to Caesars, Diaz is the first goal scorer, is up to plus 600. And that's going to be my prop for this game.
Yeah, and mine is going to be a portfolio bet that continues to not work. Toby's portfolio bets are good bets. Mine, just bet against him. But I'm going to go with the Liverpool come from behind to win or draw at plus 380. So
I like pretty solid number. I like you added the draw. I like that part.
I did. That's a good bet. Yeah. Mostly because I have zero faith in them. But no, we've talked about this before. I think with the way they're going to try to play, unless a miracle happens or Klopp suddenly becomes a pragmatist, they are going to be in for some pretty wild matches. And I mean, we'll see how this plays out over the first, you know, 5-6 matches. But I think this is going to be fairly common every time we talk about Liverpool that I'm going to be taking one of those bets.
Yeah, I like it. So you can call it a Toby portfolio bet.
All right, we're just going to call it a Toby portfolio bet to trick the universe into making it.
All right. Well, I hope the universe has not tricked me into falling in love with Chelsea. We're going to take on West Ham this week, who is 13th at 1 point. Chelsea's 11th with 1 point. This game is Sunday at 11:30 a.m. Chelsea is minus 110. West Ham is plus 300. The draw is plus 250. Chelsea minus half a goal is minus 110. West Ham is minus 120. So come on, Brett. I had as much fun as one could have at the top of the show while still keeping their clothes on. And you can't see the bottom half of me right now, so don't assume that all the clothes are still on. I can't believe I only get to watch one game a week. Like, I can't believe this is how the other half lives. I want to watch them every single day of my life right now because the vibes are so good. And the vibes are primarily so good because of Enzo Fernandez. Enzo Fernandez in that game against Liverpool looked like he is not only could be in the team of the season this year, particularly with KDB being out, he looks like he could be the player of the year in the best league of the year sometime in the very near future. He was dominant. He's still only 22, and he is about to be absolutely unleashed with the Lavia and Casado acquisitions. The role that they've had him play, like, you know, playing a little bit closer to a six, although who the hell knows where Lampard had him last year? I don't even feel like Lampard knows the number system. being able to allow him to move forward and to show that creativity that he was demonstrating against Liverpool when he was just kind of keeping the ball away from them and making super penetrating passes over and over again is just going to be a joy to watch. I don't know if he's going to be KDB, but I am anxious to find out. And Casado is going to allow him the freedom to express himself in that manner. So not only am I obviously taking Chelsea minus 110, give me Enzo, goal scorer, plus 750, Brett. He's plus 750 for a guy who might start be playing as an 8 and being their main attacker within moving into the box. And give it to me double, because with the Reece James injury this week and the swagger that Enzo has, I think he's going to be their penalty taker. I think if they point to the spot, Enzo is going to grab the ball and he is to be the one who's going to put the team on his shoulders unless Jackson is absolutely popping off in training. So if you can get any guy who plays on a team with this much attacking firepower, who's their penalty taker for an anytime goal scorer at plus 750, forget the name on the jersey. You should take that bet every time.
Yeah, and I'm really looking forward to a bunch of angry text messages when Connor Gallagher steps up to take that penalty for you.
Cardio G, baby.
No, I mean, listen, I'm still a little skeptical of what Chelsea's attack is going to look like. I saw Tactics Twitter going nuts with like Raheem Sterling's performance against Liverpool, and he did some good things, but he also, I don't think, had a single shot. And they made it seem like he was completely dominating the match. And at this point, with the injuries to Nkunku and with just Mudryk not coming through how they wanted to, there isn't that other figure that really makes me think this is an offensive.
It's Enzo. I'm telling you,
it's going to be Enzo, apparently, yes. To Toby. So no, and we're obviously I'm on the Enzo bandwagon as well. We were driving that during the World Cup. He's I think with the people like Caicedo and Lavia in the lineup next to him, he will actually start playing that 6-8 role that he was playing for Argentina a lot more. But for me, the Chelsea win at -110 was the bet. But I'm really interested in the defensive potential of this team. They have a bunch of young, energetic pressers. They have good athletes all over the pitch. Their midfield is just going to be a wall, especially in the matches where it's Enzo, Lavia, and Caicedo all together in the same midfield. If that is even supported by a back three, like, good luck getting a good shot attempt at that point.
And not just any back three. I mean, can you imagine those three, like outside of Real Madrid, who has anything even close to that in terms of a well-rounded defensive presence and being press resistant? And they have Thiago Silva standing behind them. Like, yeah. I know they have Sanchez in the goal, but the goalkeeper doesn't matter if nobody can ever get a shot off.
Exactly. I mean, that's the thing, is they're going to do such a good job, I think, of suppressing shots and making shots come from such low value areas of the pitch. We could be looking at one of the better defensive teams in the Premier League over the last 10 years, kind of a redux of the Tuchel thing. But I think that, and with that in mind, I think the bet for my prop is not necessarily a Chelsea clean sheet win, but just a plus 155 for the Chelsea clean sheet. West Ham is a very tired old squad. We talked about this last week, I think a little bit. Paqueta is the only guy like under 25 that's actually like going to get decent amount of minutes. Jared Bowen is, who kind of regressed a little bit over the last year, is sneakily older than you think. Antonio, who was their kind of the face of their revival under Moyes, is now, I think, 32 or 33. It's just not looking pretty as far as their attack is concerned. So I think with Chelsea's newfound defensive prowess and just the fact that their midfield could just be world destroyers, plus 155 for a clean sheet against West Ham just seemed like a really juicy number.
Brett, I absolutely love that bet. I was scrambling the whole time you were talking to find out if that number could actually be right. But you are spot on. In fact, I would tell the world to combine our two bets. Chelsea clean sheet win is all the way up to plus 230. So let's shake hands across the aisle. Let's do that meme where two arms are big and muscular and gripping each other and agreeing on something. And Chelsea clean sheet win versus West Ham in this match. Take the plus 230. That might go on my five pint, even though I didn't even think about it beforehand. Will you be mad?
Never, Toby. I need to see you have generational wealth off this bet. That's what I want from it.
Cool. All right. Well, we got one more match to generate some generational wealth, and it is Crystal Palace, fifth at 3 points, versus Arsenal, third at 3 points. This game is Monday at 3 p.m. Arsenal is minus 180. Palace is plus 525. Draw is plus 285. Arsenal minus half a goal is minus 180. And Caesars has Palace at plus 140. So, Brett, Palace is riding high right now. They just got an opening win, and they saved Olise, one of their star players, by doubling his wages and fighting off Chelsea, something Liverpool could not do, but Crystal Palace can do, so well done by them. They also put up 24 shots against Sheffield last week, and they were just bombarding the goal. Meanwhile, Arsenal, I thought they struggled more than I expected in that match. And the reason they won were just two moments of absolute sublime brilliance from two of the best young attackers in the world. That Martinelli like blind spin pass into space that created the goal for Nkedia was easily my favorite moment of the weekend. I could not believe how smooth and silky that was. And whether it was intentional or not, I choose to believe it was, because I jumped off my couch. I was so excited. And obviously Saka being able to under pressure whip that ball into the far corner.
Yeah, that was
those are probably my favorite two goals of the weekend. They both happened for Arsenal. But outside of those are just moments of brilliance by the team. So outside of that, I didn't think they were as good as I was expecting. And usually, Brett, if we were taping this 2 years ago on the second week of the year, I would absolutely get suckered in here by what I saw on the opening weekend and take Palace. But I've matured. I'm proud to say I think I've matured a little bit as a soccer analyst and as a bettor. So I didn't see enough in either team to sway me off of my preseason opinion of them. It's not like Arsenal was that bad or Palace was that good. And I will say Declan Rice looks like he was born to wear that jersey. It looks like he's been on Arsenal for 10 years in his very first match. And I liked his involvement going forward. I thought he was good on both ends of the pitch. I'm not sure he's going to be worth $100 million, but maybe Casado's not going to be worth $110. I've already slobbered over that signing enough, so I can't be throwing stones quite yet. So I'm going to go ahead and stick to my preseason evaluation, stick with Arsenal here, minus half a goal at minus 180, and also to win to nil at plus 130.
Yeah, I mean, Roy Hodgson, man. Just Roy Hodgson just coming back. He's never going to go away. We're always going to have Roy Hodgson here. I was pretty impressed with Palace. I mean, they took care of business. Obviously, quality of the opponent matters when you're playing a team that just is recently promoted. Not going to really be something you write home about and pat yourself on the background when you beat them. But, you know, Palace is solid, and they're going to be super solid defensively. We know how Roy Hodgson's going to play. He's going to set them up at 4-5-1. He's going to play very conservative. And they've got some personnel now where they're going to be really feisty. I mean, talk about people that are never going to go away. Jordan Ayew is starting as that defensive winger. Chick Decore, that the young midfielder signing from last year, who I think now is rumored to be on Liverpool's radar because, of course, he is a really, really good ball winner. They signed Jefferson Lerma from Bournemouth, who's kind of in that same, like, more industrious box-to-box type player role. They're just going to be tough to break down. Like, this is going to be a side that's going to be really tough to break down. And Arsenal, outside of two moments of magic, didn't do that to Nottingham Forest. And we talked a lot last year about how terrible Nottingham Forest was defensively. And Arsenal really struggled. I think it's going to be more of the same against Palace. So I'm actually taking the half a point and plus 150. With Palace, I think they got a chance. I wasn't impressed with Arsenal. Palace has been really good, not even just in their first match. Since Roy Hodgson came back, they have been very good and solid defensively. Like, they're a team that if they finished eighth or ninth this season, I wouldn't really be that shocked. Obviously, the transfer window is going to matter some if Decore leaves, but getting Olise back is huge. Him and Eze have been really bright sparks and kind of the more defensive setup. And again, I'm going to hit another under bet. So under minus 2.5 goals, or I'm sorry, under 2.5 goals at minus 120 is the bet. The juice isn't great, but again, Arsenal struggled to create against Forest. Now they're stepping up a little bit against a pretty good defensive team. I don't really see where the goals are going to come from. So,
well, I'm excited to get more data on them. I mean, Alonga made that incredible run in the 80th minute or 82nd minute, but one reason it stood out so much is they didn't really have another opportunity for the 70 minutes prior to that. There was just a couple at the beginning of the match, and then Arsenal shut them down. So let's see if they can do it against a little more exciting Crystal Palace squad that's obviously a little bit above Forest in terms of their level. So let's wrap the show up, Brett, with our 5-pint. It was a slow start for your boys last week. I am at 2.8 pints. Brett's at 3.1. But, you know, it's one data point. We got a long season to go. My 5 pints for this week is going to start with Manchester United to win at plus 130 because fade Spurs continues to be the unofficial motto of the podcast. Of course, I'm taking Chelsea to win minus 110. Portfolio bet of Manchester City to win and Haaland to score at plus 135. Spurs United over 10.5 corners at plus 105. And I'm doing it, Brett. It's not something I usually do. I usually keep my bets somewhere between like minus 150 and up to like plus 200. But give me Enzo Fernandez Anytime goal score, yeah. plus 750. I'm taking my shot.
I love those juicy numbers in front of him. Yes. Yes. And go Connor Gallagher taking penalties. Let's go. I love that. That's great. It gets me excited and makes my picks feel a little bland and boring, but we're going to roll with it. I need a bounce back week. So I'm taking the Bournemouth at +1.5 for +130 for a pint. Of course, Rashford to score in a game that's well suited for that at one pint. I am taking the under of City and Newcastle 2.5 goals at +105 for a pint. And then, of course, the big one that we all love that you were thinking that you were going to build generational wealth on, Chelsea, just a clean sheet, just a zero in front of West Ham scoreline for 2 pints at +125.
No way they end the week of great vibes with a 0-0 game. Come on, Chelsea. Up you blues. You got to put one in the net to seal this week off. All right. Well, we are sealing our own week off here on Covered in Glory, but we are excited for match day 2, and we will be back next week to talk about it with our usual interchange of horrible advice backed by expert analysis. See you next week, everyone.
Take care, guys.